Thank you for tuning in to the Helium Radio Network. You are listening to a rebroadcast of a previously recorded show.
Giving people access to insurance can be the gateway to much better health, especially for people who haven't had coverage for a long time or maybe ever. You can work in policy for a long time and never see the tangible results of it. This is an outcome every day we see people get health insurance, and that's a really exciting thing.
That's Wendy Darwell, CEO of the Suburban Hospital Alliance of New York State, and this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, bringing innovators and experts together to discuss the American healthcare system. Wendy Darwell recently took the helm at the Suburban Hospital Alliance of New York State and its regional hospital associations, the Nassau-Suffolk Hospital Council, and the Northern Metropolitan Hospital Association, where she had previously served as chief operating officer. Prior to that, she worked on Capitol Hill for the late Congressman Maurice Hinchey, so she knows as well as anyone that healthcare policy is extremely complex and its repercussions can be life-altering for individuals and families. Welcome to the podcast, Wendy, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Teresa. I'm delighted to be here.
So you took over the job at the Hospital Alliance following the retirement of Kevin Dahill, who has been a guest on our show a few months ago. But you took over during, I would say, an historically challenging period for hospitals. How is the hospital industry in New York faring now that we're 1 year into the COVID pandemic?
Well, it's hard to believe almost that it's been an entire year. It has shown just the most incredible resilience of our healthcare system, but also so many of the gaps have been exposed in our public health infrastructure and certainly in our communities, access to care. And I think that those things are going to drive a lot of the agenda going forward. For the hospitals, that has meant that they have been in the middle of a marathon now for a year. Depending on the part of the state that you're in, things were a little bit more of a lull over the summertime, but it's not like COVID ever really went away. So we have been on guard and prepared and continuing to care for patients every day now for at least a year. We hope at this point that we're in the middle and that we can see our way toward the end, but I don't think anybody believes we're quite at the end stages of this yet. So there's an exhaustion level there, I'm sure. People have worked so hard for such a long time. They've done amazing things for a disease that we knew nothing about at this time last year. We have learned so much about how to treat patients better. And our communities have responded very well too, not just in their support for doctors and nurses and healthcare institutions, but by wearing masks and taking precautions. I always say, you know, doctors and nurses don't live inside of hospitals. They live in communities. And the best way to make sure that we have enough people to take care of patients is for communities to be safe. So we've all been on this long journey. For hospitals, it's been certainly a struggle financially, operationally, but most of all in terms of their workforce. It's just been an incredibly difficult thing for caregivers to endure, seeing patients struggling so much without being able to have family at the bedside in many cases to comfort them, long hours, you know, very, very challenging environment. And we've got a long way to go to recover from that.
Yeah. So it's been a physical and emotional strain on staff.
Oh, absolutely. It's been, I think it's reflected in the fact that retirement rates have been up at the end of last year, which I think was probably not a surprise to anyone who works in human resources, that just the toll of this really extraordinary experience is playing out in that way.
So aside from COVID, if we can put it aside for a moment, what are some of the most pressing issues other than the pandemic that hospitals are concerned about right now?
You know, COVID's going to cast a very long shadow over healthcare operations and healthcare policy for a very long time, if for no other reason than that the financial impact, both on government, on healthcare institutions, is profound. And so normally at this time of year, we would be looking at whatever is in the state budget. We'd be going up to Albany and waving signs and advocating for our member hospitals, for good healthcare policy and appropriate funding levels. This year, we're obviously not going there in person. We're doing a lot of Zoom meetings with our legislators. But we have an environment in terms of the state budget, and this is true in entirely different ways in Washington, that just reflects the strain that COVID has put on government funding and government revenue. Because with the high levels of unemployment, all of this dislocation in the economy, you have a real reduction in revenue to the state and federal government. So, you know, that really changes what we have the ability to focus on. But I would say that it also gives us some opportunities to move the ball forward on things that we've worked on for years. So I'll give two examples that aren't, one is COVID related, but speaks to broader issues. We've worked hard over the years to try to get some regulatory relief, particularly from state government. New York is one of the most heavily regulated healthcare environments in the country. And what we found over the course of the past year was that there are an awful lot of regulations that we could live without and still provide safe patient care. And it, you know, didn't make the world come to an end. The reason we know that is because so many of those regulations were waived as part of the COVID response. So things like allowing out-of-state practitioners to provide care to patients in New York hospitals, that was a waiver that had to happen. That was necessary in order for us to be able to get enough clinicians at the bedside to take care of patients here. It's the way that all of those 70,000 volunteers from around the country last spring were able to come to New York and be deployed very quickly. We had rules prohibiting that needed to be waived. We have rules about how you can make operational and physical space changes to respond to an emergency. So if you think about, particularly back in the spring when testing capabilities were really limited, we had to really restrict people coming through the door of healthcare facilities. So in a lot of cases, that meant setting up triage tents in the parking lot so that you could identify whether a patient was a likely COVID patient or not, channel them through one door or the other based on that. Having that tent in the parking lot and having that triage happen in a different place than your emergency room, those are things that in normal times require an application process to the state and a lengthy approval process. Some other examples, there are a lot of them that are clinically related with regard to allowing clinicians to work to the fullest extent of their education. There are a lot of ways in which the scope of practice for some clinicians was really waived and allowed to have more flexibility. Those are just a few examples of things that we would advocate for at any other time. But right now, we've got proof of concept because we've been living without a lot of those regulations for nearly a year now. And I think this is an opportunity to try to advance some of those issues because we can say, look, in the worst of circumstances, we were able to do what we needed to do given these flexibilities. And frankly, we couldn't have been successful without it. So I think that's one way that COVID, if you can find some lemonade out of lemons, is that's an opportunity for us to try to make some progress on other policy agenda items. Another is managed care reform. That's always been a hallmark of the Suburban Hospital Alliance. It's actually the reason that the Long Island Hospital Association came together with the Hudson Valley Association originally was over managed care reform issues. And this, again, is an area where COVID has impacted and I think ultimately may help some of our broader policy goals. You know, back at the beginning of the crisis last spring, everybody from every corner wanted to know what they could do to help from all segments of the economy, except for health insurers. And they really had to be pushed into by state regulation, freeing up cash for healthcare providers who had seen all of their elective procedures shut down. You know, most of their other revenue sources were shut down. And still, managed care plans were holding on to payments that they could have made for care that had already been provided. They could have been more helpful in easing the transition of patients. You know, there are prior authorization processes that take multiple days. They just hold up patient care. We've been in an environment where holding up patient care, what could have been tragic, perhaps not for that patient, perhaps for the next patient to come through the door because we needed to be able to move patients through facilities. And ultimately, the State Department of Financial Services, which regulates commercial insurance plans, did issue some regulations, and they waived some of their rules and forced the managed care plans out of their comfort zone. But frankly, even then, some of them have not been complying. So again, we sort of have proof here that many of the managed care reforms that we've been advocating for over the years really are necessary, because when push comes to shove, we were not able to get the support from that element of the healthcare system that we really needed, and more importantly, that patients really needed. So I think we have some opportunities there to advance our agenda. One thing that we've been talking with legislators about, and we're certainly joined in this with our state healthcare association, HANES, is the idea of having a Community Reinvestment Act type mechanism for health insurers. Back in the late 1970s, the Community Reinvestment Act was passed by the federal government to govern the financial services industry when there was broad redlining of communities. You know, banks would come into a community, they'd make profits, but they wouldn't issue any loans and they wouldn't open accounts for people who actually lived in those communities. The Community Reinvestment Act was a mechanism to make sure that they did. If you're going to do business here, you need to make a commitment to that community. What we see now on the health insurance landscape is you have these major national and multinational corporations that provide health insurance to people in our communities, largely paid for by businesses in our communities. But the profits from that health insurance go to shareholders somewhere else. We think that those health insurers ought to have an obligation to reinvest in the communities where they do business. And there's a good, you know, mesh here with COVID recovery. What we've learned over the past year, or we knew it, but it's been reinforced, is that there is immense value to care that's provided in a healthcare institution, but patients are never going to be completely successful if we don't address some of their needs outside the walls of the hospital. So if you don't have the transportation to get to a follow-up doctor's appointment, if you can't afford the pharmaceutical treatment, if you live in a food desert and you don't have great access to nutritious food, or don't even know what the most nutritious food would be given your health condition, all of those kinds of issues that impact a patient's health take place outside of the walls of the hospital. We really need to address those kind of needs within our communities, and having the health insurers who stand to benefit from this, right? If people are healthier, they spend less money on the provision of care. We'd like to see community reinvestment happen in that way.
Wow, you really touched on a lot of hot topics there. Those social determinants of health, I think COVID has also really shined a bright light on the fact that they exist and that their impact is so keenly felt by certain communities, here on Long Island and across the country as well.
Absolutely. We know that we have communities that are not only segregated, but badly cut off from access to care, where there is not a lot of primary care available, where the transportation and nutritious food and all of those elements are really challenged. More importantly, I think we have a much better recognition of as a society of how and where people work impacts their health care. If you're a grocery store worker, you are among the most exposed people to COVID. You are not all that likely to have health insurance. You don't make it, you may have a pretty modest salary. So your ability to afford care and maybe meet some of those other needs that are necessary for good health, that's pretty limited. We really exposed all of those faults in our public health infrastructure through COVID. And we know that the folks in that position are much more likely to be Black or Brown. Minority communities suffered disproportionately. And I think, again, if we could find any sort of silver lining, there is so much more recognition of that. Not that it's new information, but much broader recognition of vulnerable populations and at-risk populations just because of the nature of where they live and the kind of work that they do. Both at the state and federal level, we see a great deal of attention to this. And although we've been working on these kind of population health issues for a number of years, I think we're going to have a lot more in the way of allies and momentum.
And buy-in, sure. Well, I want to definitely come back and talk more about these issues, but it's time for us to take a very brief break right now. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back with more from Wendy Darwell. What lies ahead for providers in our new post-COVID healthcare world? Find out at the 5th annual Toolkit for Independence event, going virtual for the first time this year. Save your spot for Thursday, March 25th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You'll hear from expert speakers, participate in workshops, and browse vendor displays showcasing products and services to help you thrive in 2021 and beyond. It's free for physicians and office managers. A limited number of sponsorships and exhibitor spots are available. For additional information, call 631-606-0525. That's 631-606-0525. Welcome back to Healthcare Confidential. We're here with Wendy Darwell, CEO of the Suburban Hospital Alliance of New York State. And Wendy, you're stepping into this new role just about, a month or two ago?
Mm-hmm.
Not that long ago. You're stepping into this new role just as a new administration takes over in Washington, D.C. And by all accounts and expectations, the Biden administration will chart a course that's completely different from the one that the previous administration was on. So what are your predictions, if you have any, about how the Biden administration and its healthcare policies might impact the healthcare industry nationally and in New York in particular?
Well, job number one, I think they've made it very clear, is to beat COVID. I do think that they are approaching the response to the pandemic very differently than the previous administration, even in the very short time that they've been in office. Going back to some of those social determinants of health issues we talked about, I think there's a real awareness there. Even in the very first legislative package that they proposed It's very focused on the public health infrastructure, and that's a notable difference. Their focus is on testing and tracing, increasing vaccine production, increasing production of PPE, and getting those out into the community as quickly as possible. So I do think it helps. They are bringing back a lot of veterans of the Obama administration and some even from the Clinton administration. So as opposed to the last administration where, really their hallmark was that they were Washington outsiders, that's certainly not the case when you have a president who spent, 40 plus years in public office. He's got a lot of connections in Washington, and that brought a lot of people who are experienced in government, know how to make government work. And I think we're starting to see that in terms of, a more orderly vaccine program, for example, than we had before. And I think they're more willing to use the instruments of government to try to respond to this. So I think in the short run, it's all COVID all the time. Very hard to focus on anything besides that. But I think, once you get beyond that, the thing that is most important to this administration, and certainly there were lots of sound bites about it on the campaign trail, is fixing but not replacing the Affordable Care Act. And it's something that President Biden considers a major accomplishment, but acknowledges there are some things that need to work better. And we've already seen that start to happen. They've extended the enrollment period for the health insurance exchange, which is very good news, particularly for people who, have lost their jobs or have had significant changes in economic circumstances. I think they're going to take some steps to shore up the insurance market. There were some regulatory changes under the last administration where they really weakened the insurance rules that were designed to make the ACA not just effective, but affordable for consumers. And just last week, I think it was, they reversed position on the case that's before the Supreme Court on the constitutionality of the ACA. So that's a sort of big picture messaging issue. And then at the very small level, they operational level, they're making changes on COVID response.
Do you think the individual mandate might be back on the table?
Well, that's hard to say because we have such a closely divided Congress. There had been the thought, if you go back, 6 or 8 months from now, that if there, were a Democratic-controlled Senate with a pretty strong majority, that what happened in the Supreme Court case wouldn't really matter because the Congress would be able to make changes to the law to bring back the individual mandate, make other changes to the ACA, and ultimately that would sort of negate what any ruling from the Supreme Court might be. That's not the circumstance now. So I think anything that, it will be very difficult to make significant changes like the Affordable Care Act. I think a lot of that energy right now is going into COVID aid and probably will next go into transportation reform. I don't think they want to use the mechanisms available to them to ram through a significant health reform.
You touched upon earlier some of the outreach initiatives and public health projects that the Hospital Alliance has been involved with. Can you tell us and tell our listeners a little bit more about that work?
Absolutely. It's work I'm really incredibly proud of. And one of the reasons that I came back to New York 13, 14 years ago to take this job. We have had a history for more than 20 years of providing health insurance enrollment assistance through our Long Island branch, the Nassau-Suffolk Hospital Council. As health insurance programs have changed over the years, that role has changed. We've had a number of different grant programs, starting with the original Children's Health Insurance Program. We provide services in the community to assist people in getting enrolled. It's certainly a lot different now than it was back in 2000 in terms of the ability to do things like this over the internet. But people need help sometimes. You know, all of these insurance programs require information about personal finances and family arrangements. And both of those things can be really complicated. And sometimes you just need people with special expertise to help you through the applications. So that's what my staff does on a regular basis. In normal times, we would go out to community centers and parishes and libraries and assist people out in the community. Obviously, right at this moment in time, that's not feasible. Even if we could go, there wouldn't be anybody there. But we are continuing to provide services. Right now, we're focused on Medicaid enrollment for the age, blind, and disabled population. I forget the exact number, but I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 people that we have assisted over the years in getting health coverage.
That's tremendous.
It's a pretty remarkable number because I'm talking about three or four people on my staff at any one time who are doing that work. And they do really terrific work. They've got great expertise. And it's such a tangible way to try to change the healthcare system. Giving people access to insurance can be the gateway to much better health, especially for people who haven't had coverage for a long time or maybe ever. So I say that's one of the reasons that I moved to Long Island to take this job, because you can work in policy for a long time and never see the tangible results of it. This is an outcome every day we see people get health insurance, and that's a really exciting
thing. Sounds really rewarding.
It's very rewarding. And then a few years ago, we sort of jumped into the world of population health. We have been involved on behalf of our members on a number of community health initiatives over the years, but a grant opportunity opened up to support something we were already doing called the Long Island Health Collaborative. And that was a mechanism for bringing together a really diverse set of community partners working in the same on the same couple of issues to improve community health. So there are obligations both for hospitals and for county health departments to identify a couple of issues that they are going to focus on to improve community health. What we did, first on our, under our own initiative and then through the state grant program, was to get everybody working together on the same couple of goals so that we could really magnify the impact of those efforts. Instead of having 23 hospitals and two county health departments working on 25 different things. The funding for that program has gone away for the moment. We're still looking for ways to keep that initiative going, but it gave us a way to bring together not just those entities, but all kinds of providers, community organizations, religious organizations, the health plans, really everybody that has a stake in community health, and try to get us all working in the same direction.
That's fantastic. So, looking ahead, as we talk about the rewards of the work that you're doing now versus being, you know, on Capitol Hill and working strictly on policy, what are your priorities you personally for the next year? So a year from now, what do you think you will have accomplished that will make you look back and say, that was good, you know, look back with pride and feel that you've accomplished what you set out to do in the first year?
Well, I sure hope that we have vaccines so plentiful and available and people willing to be vaccinated that we can say we've crossed that herd immunity threshold From a personal perspective, my number one hobby is travel. So it's been a consequence of COVID it has been very difficult. I can't wait till we're back out there again. It also means that I get to get out of this office or my home office where I am most of the time and travel out to see my members and see the great work that they're doing in person again. So that would mean that we have, if we're doing that at this time next year, that would mean that we have made such significant progress in beating COVID. But after that, I think the real goal is stability for the healthcare system. Last year was financially devastating for many providers, which of course doesn't compare to the personal devastation of families who lost loved ones. But we need for our health systems to stay strong so that they can continue to take care of patients. So my number one job and how I'll gauge my success is whether we've managed to advocate successfully in the policy world for the tools and resources to enable them to do that, and so that we have a clear pathway going forward. And that has to include that we've got a pathway for addressing a lot of these community needs we've talked about, because that's good for everybody.
Well, that's a tall order. It sounds like you're going to be very busy. So I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us and sharing your perspectives here on Healthcare Confidential. Wendy Darwell, where can our listeners learn more?
You can go to our website, which is suburbanhospitalalliance.org. And you'll find links there for our two regional hospital associations. You can also find out more information about our health insurance programs at coverage4healthcare.org.
And is that Long Island only, or is that statewide? Or
that's Long Island only, but you'll find information there about eligibility that could help you anywhere in the state.
Perfect. Thank you again. And I want to remind listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available on heliumradio.com on Mondays at 10 a.m. on the Care One Network and at 2 p.m. on the Life Improvement Radio Network. You can listen on demand wherever you access podcasts. Our show is produced by Life Improvement Media with thanks to Eric Remmel and Justin Ulrich, and our theme song is an original composition written and performed by the multi-talented Patrick Bakarsik. Before we go, I want to also remind listeners that the 5th Annual Toolkit for Independence, a virtual conference dedicated to the success of America's independent doctors, will be held on March 25th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Secure your free guest ticket or join us as a sponsor. Learn more at toolkitforindependence.com. That's toolkitforindependence, as one big word, .com. And if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Helium Radio. The views expressed by show hosts or their guests are their own and should not be construed in any way as advice from Helium Radio. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our website. Personal perspectives expressed by producers, writers, and editors will always be presented as such. Any rebroadcast or retransmission without the express written consent of Helium Radio is strictly prohibited. Thanks for listening.